From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the list of candidates to head Boston's public schools is down to three.
We're very excited. We have three very highly qualified candidates that have been culled from a beginning list of around 150.
Also today, the opinion piece that ticked off the Boston Globe's owners, in which the author wrote he regretted not peeing on a famous conservative salmon.
Pretty sure it was going to be received as the fairly provocative take that it is, but I write this sort of thing like every day. That's the whole reason I agreed to write a column there in the first place.
And should Massachusetts not have joined the United States?
Massachusetts' ratification of the United States Constitution was a disaster. It was a terrible thing for Massachusetts.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. The Boston School Committee has officially announced the finalists for the superintendent position for the district. School Committee member Michael Lecanto spoke with reporters about the finalists and the search process earlier today.
We're very excited. We have three very highly qualified candidates that have been culled from a beginning list of around 150.
We're going to take a closer look now at those three finalists with WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin. Max, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Jill.
So it has been a long search. It's been about 9-10 months. Maybe I'm a little off there between the time Tommy Chang resigned since the end of last school year. We're down to three finalists. Who made the cut? And so far, any objections to anyone?
Well, we've got three people. There's Brenda Caselius, who is the former head of the Minnesota Department of Education. You've got Marie Izquierdo, who's the chief academic officer for the Miami-Dade County Public Schools. And then Oscar Santos, who's the head of school at Cathedral High School, which is in the south end of Boston. All three are people of color. They're relatively close in age, mid-40s, early 50s, and all three started in the classroom and spent their careers in education.
That's a lot of equality in there in different ways. Let's start with Brenda Caselius. Tell us what you can about her her history, her background.
She's interesting. She climbed all the way up the education career ladder, mostly in Minnesota. Her resume says she started as a paraprofessional in special education 30 years ago. She taught for several years, and then she started to rise through administrative ranks. And eventually, she oversaw all of Minnesota's public schools as their commissioner from 2011 until just this past January when a new governor came in. And in between, she worked for Carol Johnson, who may be familiar to some of our listeners, in Memphis. Johnson served as Boston's superintendent for nearly 6 years, which is actually kind of a long time to hold that job. And Caselius sees Johnson as a key mentor for her.
All right. But so she is not only applying for the Boston job, is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. She's also a finalist for Michigan State Superintendent of Education. And she'll be interviewing for that on April 22nd, next Monday, and then interviewing for this job on the following day, the 23rd.
That's a very tight schedule. So we'll all know soon. So another candidate, Marie Izquierdo. What is her background?
Izquierdo is the daughter of a Cuban immigrant. She worked both for the state of Florida and more recently for Miami-Dade. She was seen as an advocate for sort of high-tech learning, Jill. She got $1 billion-plus into classrooms, buying computers, renovating learning spaces. And she's the only one of the three candidates without a doctorate. But she was a fellow at what's called the Broad Academy until last year. That's a program that's seen as a way to train professional school leaders with, some people would say, a kind of business-minded approach to the job.
Is that here in this in Boston? Or
it's a national program.
Oscar Santos, the third candidate, is a name that some may be familiar with if they have kids in school. He worked in the Boston Public Schools since 1996. He's currently running Cathedral High School in the South End. What do we know about Oscar Santos?
Yeah, Santos is sort of the purest local boy in the group. He went to Boston College. He started teaching at English High in Boston in 1996. He was also a headmaster in Boston and the superintendent of Randolph Public Schools. And for the last 6 years, almost, he's run Cathedral High, which is a private Catholic high school that serves a lot of low-income students.
There is a little bit of a question about him, at least from some students from the high school now, from Cathedral High. They're speaking out. What are they saying about him?
Yeah, we reached out a bit today, and there were certainly some students at Cathedral who didn't see him as a perfect leader for the school. They said Santos was generally slow to hire more diverse faculty there, even though their student body is overwhelmingly Black and Latino. I spoke to Amel Viaud, who graduated from Cathedral 2 years ago, and she said, it took her by surprise.
And it baffles me how this man is of Latino descent and does not see the importance in diversifying. If he could not do that before, I do not think that he could execute that now.
Hiring a more diverse staff, Jill, is one of the goals that we have
the district has for
the next superintendent. On the other hand, Santos could reasonably sell himself as a really effective academic leader. He could tout rising test scores when he was running the increasingly diverse Randolph District, and he continued this trend of sending all of Cathedral High seniors onto college.
So it's good to remember and remind ourselves why we are here at this point of hiring another superintendent. Tommy Chang resigned unexpectedly last June. Maybe a mutual agreement or not. We don't know exactly. Friction with Mayor Walsh, we hear. There was pushback to how Laura Perel was named interim superintendent. Can you talk about the context of this search process?
Yeah, I think there's a sense that the people want to feel a little bit more engaged in these processes. There's a sense that Chang had a strong, strong vision for what he wanted to do with the district, but he wasn't always the best at getting people on board, whether that's elected officials or educators or community members. And I think it's worth noting that the new job description, Jill, calls for a superintendent who'd be a bit more visible and actively engaged in schools. That's a quote. They want someone who'd develop working relationships and build a motivated professional culture in the district. So they may be looking for people skills
Somebody who gets out of their own office.
Yes.
Okay.
But then we'll also get a more thorough introduction than we're used to these three finalists. Each one is going to do a full day of interviews and panels with different groups, one by one. That'll be Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of next week. And that could be a response to the feeling that Mayor Walsh kind of went ahead and appointed Laura Perel, something that should have been the responsibility sort of normally of the school committee. And people have grumbled about that ever since.
So this is not necessarily a smooth ground that this is all going forward on. And the city itself is going through some pretty big issues that will be on the plate of the next superintendent. Like the Boston School Committee passed this more than $1 billion budget last month. And that could lead to some significant cuts in funding for some schools in the city. So what are the biggest challenges laid out at the moment for the Boston Public Schools, as you see them as a reporter, but what you've been hearing?
I think this is a job that chews people up, Jill, whether it's Boston or somebody else. It's never easy running a district of this size. You got 56,000 plus kids, more than 120 separate schools, and they're all growing and shrinking and changing at different rates. So let's just bracket the money concerns alone. You have some people who say the district is a bit bloated. They want the district to find ways to cut the cost of administration, say, or the cost of transportation. But then you've got another side now where the next superintendent is going to be expected to be an advocate. More and more, Mayor Walsh is arguing that Boston schools simply aren't getting enough support from the state, and he's thrown his weight behind a bill that could steer millions of state dollars into the district each year.
And there is less federal money coming in overall every state, so there's a factor there as well.
Absolutely. That's a trend nationwide.
When we get down to the nitty-gritty of hiring a new superintendent in the city of Boston, who will have the final word? You have a school committee that will make a final selection in the process, but we saw that there was a great tension between Mayor Walsh and Tommy Chang, and that was a factor in Chang's departure. So what is the mayor's role in this process, and how much influence does he actually have, if we know?
Formally, Jill, it's not his decision to make. It's the school committee. That's what school committees are for, right? They hire and fire superintendents. But Boston is alone in this state as a standalone municipal school district with an appointed school committee. And who does the appointing? It's the mayor. And again, Walsh did let it slip some months ago that he was disappointed in Tommy Chang's struggle to implement big changes, like an overhaul of when schools start and end in the city, or there was an attempt to save money on busing that didn't produce the gains that they hoped for. So I think Walsh made it clear that he wants somebody who's maybe a bit more politically deft, better at selling the changes, not just dreaming them up.
So when we talked about Chang's departure over the summer on Radio Boston, we spoke with Paul Revel, former Massachusetts Secretary of Education, and also with Elizabeth Reilinger, who is the former chair of the Boston School Committee. And they both talked about how challenging it is, as you said, Max, to do this job, but specifically due to a politically active community, including parents and a network of partners and shareholders. And that is not unlike a lot of city districts, but this is a large city. Was that something the search committee considered? And do you think that that would give Oscar Santos an inside track, who's already in the district, in a school building?
Yeah, I think that that is a place where you might see Walsh's impact. He often sort of jokingly remarked on the fact that Tommy Chang and former Education Secretary Ron Dorsey were not locals. And as a diehard sports fan, I think Walsh would be all too aware of a sort of Boston effect that can come to some newcomers. You think of baseball players like Carl Crawford and David Price, former Celtics coach Rick Pitino. There's a lot of people who have come to Boston and said, the culture here is way too critical, way too negative for its own good. So school committee chair Michael LeCanto earlier today did say that the committee looked for people who knew this area.
We wanted people that had some knowledge of the city of Boston or some knowledge of what it would be like to lead a large urban district and a district that's as invested politically and community-wise, partner-wise, as Boston is. And so we were, we placed a primacy on that.
Yeah, so looking for somebody who can kind of feel out the native ways. I think that said, Jill, Oscar Santos is the only sort of true local in this group. I didn't see any evidence that either of the women has spent substantial time working in this district, but I suppose you could take that into consideration if you're handicapping the race at home.
Yes, if you're using all these metaphors, yes, in schools and sports. But there is also some notion that it's hard to bring a great leader to a great city, with all these challenges. That could be also Chicago and Philadelphia, but there's been a lot of turnover here. How much freedom do you think that next superintendent will have to set that agenda, given what's ahead already on the plate?
Well, I think that's a great question, Jill. Walsh had a telling line in Adrian Walker's Globe column last month saying Boston is, quote, a great place to learn how to be a superintendent. And I think that's telling. There's a sense that Walsh wants a superintendent who hasn't had this exact sort of job before. And indeed, none of these candidates has been a big city superintendent before. They've had other prominent roles. And I think that's because some of the superintendent's agenda has already been decided in advance. The district's in the middle of Build BPS, which is a billion-dollar plan to reshape the district. And that's already underway. Schools are going to close. Other ones will be renovated. And I know some activists are hoping that the superintendent will be able to push back on that trend, like Kevin Murray. He's with Quest, which is a parents group.
So given the tendency towards consolidation and privatization in the system, we really want to be able to discover that the next superintendent is going to be a champion for our public schools.
So I don't know how wide open next week's panels will be, but I certainly hope we'll get to hear the finalists engage with that idea of when it's appropriate to close a school.
Quickly, Max, we have just about 30 seconds. This all in the context of the city of Boston, which has seen a lot of growth in real estate development and transportation investments and a lot of challenges with affordable housing as well. We've got an achievement gap in the district as well. These issues are all something the next superintendent could possibly try to address. Can any of this, though, the affordability of a city, be fixed through a school?
I think that is really difficult. The job description makes it clear that closing that achievement gap is absolutely job one. But, I don't think there's anyone who thinks that a starkly segregated, on racial and economic lines city, that all those problems can be solved in a school building, Jill.
All right, Max Larkin, thank you so much. WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin will be reporting on this story, I'm sure, as we find out who the next superintendent is. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jill.
This is WBUR's Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. A media dish of sorts continues to simmer this week over an online opinion piece in the Boston Globe that was posted last week and then taken down. You might have caught it. In the piece, the writer, Luke O'Neill, described a choice he made a decade ago as a waiter in Cambridge not to urinate on the salmon he was serving one evening to conservative political analyst Bill Kristol. O'Neill also wrote that not doing so was one of his biggest regrets in life. And within a day of this column being up, Backlash mounted. The Globe edited the piece, first to make the language less guttural. Then the article caught the attention of the owners of the Boston Globe, Linda and John Henry, who condemned its publication, and the piece was removed. The Globe then published a note to readers explaining why the column was removed, stating it, quote, did not receive sufficient editorial oversight and did not meet Globe standards. The Globe also said it, quote, regrets its lack of vigilance on the matter and noted that the author is not a member of its staff. The piece can be found through a web archive through the Washington Post, which reported also on the story, which is how we have looked at the piece today. Luke O'Neill is with us right now. He has in the past contributed arts pieces to the Boston Globe. He also writes for Boston Magazine, and he lists many other outlets on his bio, including the Wall Street Journal, the Village Voice, the Huffington Post, McSweeney's, and he publishes his own work on his subscription-based website, Welcome to Hell World. Luke O'Neill, thanks so much for joining us now via Skype.
Hi there, how are you?
Good, it's good to meet you. I've been reading a lot of your work today. Your piece, the specific Boston Globe piece we're talking about, was largely about the resignation of former Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen. She was among a number of Trump cabinet officials who at some point shame-marched out of restaurants and theaters. Nielsen, because of the policy last year that she oversaw separating families at the U.S. border. But you start this piece with a paragraph on that restaurant episode that we talked about a moment ago with Bill Kristol. What is the connection? How did you narratively get there?
Well, the main reason I started with that is because it's very clearly a funny joke. And, you know, obviously I was never going to actually pee in somebody's dish. And I'm going to have to try really hard to not say the other word here, I'm told.
So we're told.
Yes. And that would be a really insane thing to do. But, as I do in much of my writing, I'm using crude hyperbole to sort of make a point, which is that people who are responsible for the suffering of thousands like Kristen Nielsen or people who cheerlead the country with the ear of the president into an illegal war that led to the deaths of 500,000 people. I think it might be okay for us in general to be somewhat rude to those type of people in public.
So, Luke O'Neill, we're going to stick with you and your column for just a few minutes, and then we're also want to hear from our listeners. We have John Carroll in the studio as well. Listeners, we do want to hear from you. If you saw this article in The Globe when it was first published, what did you make of it? And is there a point that you think at which political commentary goes too far in print or online? And did this piece for you as a reader reach that point? Or is the commentary justified? We want to know what you also think about the Globe's editorial decision to eventually pull the story. That's a bold and new kind of move in media, in a mainstream media. Was it the right one? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So I'm sorry, Luke, just to do a little business there. Luke O'Neill, do you have any reservations or did you have reservations or concerns when you wrote the piece in a tone that is different from other pieces that you have written for The Globe, even in the last, even in March and April, that are also politically left? But this one, you went with an editor. Were you worried about the tone that you had in that lead paragraph, especially, and then about having it published?
I just want to be clear that what we're talking about here is an administration with an explicit policy of tearing families apart and putting babies in cages and misplacing children throughout the country. I refuse to pretend that there's anything offensive about me saying, you know, a pee in someone's dish. I'm not going to accept any sort of, you know, blame or anything. It's just silly to me.
Okay, that, so let me just see if I could rephrase this. So it was not a big deal for you to submit this to an editor, and you did not expect, I imagine, then, that this was going to be having the kind of backlash that you've witnessed and having the piece pulled?
No, not really. I write this sort of stuff all the time. And, it tends to be received in the tone that it's meant to be until, you know, there's like this faux outrage. This is something that the right does all the time. They try to work the refs and they do these like phony, you know, emails and call-ins saying they're canceling their subscriptions. And, you know, legacy media still doesn't know how to deal with that sort of thing. They're still being somehow outflanked by, you know, these people on the right who are much savvier about this sort of stuff than newspaper editors.
I want to mention that we did reach out to the Boston Globe to join us today. They couldn't make anyone available, but they did issue a statement. And it is that the, quote, the Globe opinion page removed from our website, the April 10 column by freelance writer Luke O'Neill on former Homeland Security Chief Kirsten Nielsen, the column should never have been published. Editorial protocol was not followed, and the column did not receive sufficient editorial oversight. Globe Opinion is a platform for a variety of viewpoints and welcomes a range of voices to promote discussion on important topics in a productive way. Again, that is the statement we got from the Globe today about this column, Luke O'Neill. And I want to ask, did you have any agency in the re-editing of the first line when the first edit happened before the column was taken down with a Globe editor?
Yeah, by the time that they were freaking out, my immediate editor sent me something. And by this point, I was like already getting inundated by people harassing me on my Twitter. So I was just like, do whatever you want. I don't care. But then I had nothing to do. They didn't even tell me about the taking it down or any of the further edits after that. I was not consulted, nor have I heard from anyone there. Except for my immediate editor, who also seems to be in trouble at this point.
Luke O'Neill is with us. Listeners, he is a journalist who has in the past contributed to the Boston Globe and other publications, and a piece of his was, which we'll talk more about in a moment, was taken down by the Globe last week. We want to hear from you. If you saw that op-ed piece about peeing in a conservative's food, did it go too far for you as a reader, and did the Globe make the right wrong move or the wrong move in pulling the piece down? Please give us a call today at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Luke O'Neill, I want to bring John Carroll in on this. He is WBUR senior news analyst. He's the author of It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town blog. I love that. It just, you know, we're talking about what, you know, what we read and what we devour every day in terms of papers, I imagine. John, it's good to see you again also after a long time. Do you two know each other? Have you met?
No, we haven't.
Well, introductions are here.
Hello, Luke.
Hey, how are you?
I want to know what you thought of the piece, if you first saw it when it was live.
Well, I did not see it when it was live. I saw it in the aftermath. And it comes as part of a sort of a wave of columns and opinions about departing Trump administration officials, current Trump administration officials, that, you know, they shouldn't have a soft landing when they leave and go and wind up on corporate boards and in academic institutions or over at the International House of Politics at Harvard. They should basically pay a price for what they have done. There have been a number of those columns out there. So I think, you know, from that standpoint, this was very much in the mainstream of a certain line of opinion. I think that the Boston Globe is looking for new readers. I think that they're looking for younger readers. And I think that they realize that younger readers want news with an attitude, with an edge. A lot of organizations think they want to be provocative and edgy, and then they find out the hard way that they don't really want to be.
And Luke O'Neill, are you working with the Globe any longer? Do you know what your relationship is with them? Have you heard from them?
Well, my relationship with them was my choice, and I announced that I was quitting immediately once they deleted the piece, because why would I work with a place that's going to throw me under the bus like that ever again?
John, you, as the things that you have just described in a changing world, looking for audience, you've written for the Boston Globe, and you still write for the Boston Globe?
I did not still write for the Boston Globe, but I did a lot of freelance work for the Globe in the late 80s and all through the 90s. And it was a different world. It was a print world. And I had different relationships with editors. Some of them were good. Some of them were bad. I had one editor who, when he had to shorten a piece, just lopped off the last sentence of every paragraph. It was like a Texas chainsaw edit. You know, I had other editors who were great and collaborative. It depends on the individual. But it was a much simpler time. I think there's a sort of a disconnection here, and the difference between online publication and print publication is something that is becoming coming into clearer and clearer focus all the time.
Right, and so John, I don't know if you've read Luke O'Neill's website, but
I have.
But okay, so there are these articles there. You write beautifully. I might say I'm enjoying your reading, whether or not I agree or not. It's just some great writing there, and it's provocative, and it's filled with imagery and metaphor, and it's as your, you know, website, as, you know, you might be able to say the same things on the Trevor Noah Show, on The Daily Show, or on, you know, Stephen Colbert. Maybe the Boston Globe, as John, you were saying, is not the place. But how do we know and why and who is rewriting the rules in terms of print, traditional media versus online? Luke or John?
Go ahead, Luke. I'll give it to you.
I am sympathetic to that in a way. Like, if my editor had said, oh, can you tone this down a little bit before publishing, I would have taken the edit. Like, I'm not an insane person, you know. It wasn't absolutely imperative for me to get that particular imagery into a piece. But I think the point John makes about, you know, legacy publications thinking that they want to be edgier and getting, you know, younger readers and things like that, and then immediately regretting it once they get the, you know, the smallest amount of blowback, I think that's a very good one. And I don't remember what the first part of the question was, because I was just thinking about how you said nice words about my writings.
Well, forget it. Your articles are very hard to read. And I actually had to look up a lot of words, by the way, as you probably know. I said basically that the question is who will rewrite these rules? How will they be rewritten? And because this is very fast paced, John, right? This is not, we're writing still. The things to write about are always there, whether it's politics or the arts.
Right. There's another aspect to this, too, and it's generational. So, you know, this piece was pulled from the website at the insistence of John Henry and Linda Pizzuti Henry. John Henry is the owner and publisher. Linda Pizzuti Henry is the managing director of the Globe. This is a generational issue as much as anything else. And for them, it was, I believe, a matter of propriety. It's kind of an old-fashioned term. But there are different definitions of what is acceptable, what is respectable, and what is not. And I think that a generational gap is basically at work here. Mm-hmm. And also, I think that a lot of times the legacy media don't really have a sufficient grasp of the dynamics of the digital world. And I think that that they learned some lessons really the hard way. Mm-hmm.
And just to be clear also, this article, Luke O'Neill, your column, was not in the print version of the Boston Globe.
It was online,
the new branch. Let's get some listeners involved here. We are talking about an op-ed piece. I'm sorry, not an op-ed piece. We are talking about an opinion piece that was in the Boston Globe online last week, written by Luke O'Neill, who joins us now. John Carroll is here, also senior news analyst for WBUR. In that, Luke O'Neill made a reference to peeing on the dish of a conservative food. The dish of a conservative politician. He was a waiter in Cambridge. This was 10 years ago. It was Bill Kristol, another political time. The Globe pulled the piece, essentially. We want to hear from Galen now in Newton. Thanks for joining us on Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for taking my call. It's a real privilege. I wanted to say that Mr. O'Neill should be commended, if anything, for taking a humorous tack at something that's really a brazen human rights violation of hundreds of thousands of people who are trying to find safety, and to be able to poke at it with jest is admirable, because there are plenty of other ways to express outrage with this administration. And if anything, the paper's decision to pull it is pretty sad. I mean, I majored in history in college and did archival research for 2 years on major newspapers from the 1800s, and people were saying far worse things about politicians of both stripes. Shouldn't matter either, liberal or conservative news outlet, Wall Street Journal or Boston Globe. I mean, this is a serious issue, and if you can bring attention to it and bring someone into the fold, maybe it's someone who prefers humor, that's great. The more people who actually read about this rather than responding to it via a tweet is something that's really important.
Right. And though, Galen,
Mr. O'Neill,
on the flip side, Galen, there were people who maintained that Luke O'Neill's column was a call for violence, and that is something else. And I just want to ask you a quick question. If you had seen it, is it different for you in print versus online to see a column as such? Is there a place? Is there a place where this kind of column shouldn't have been placed, Galen?
I think it's probably even more dangerous to place it online than it is to put it in print. I mean, look at the number of people who read the current occupant of the White House's tweets. What he did, for instance, with Ilhan Omar, that's as much a call to that's as much violence as this piece is, if you want to put it that way.
Okay, we will take that one on another day. It's a big conversation too. Listeners, we are talking about an op-ed piece described this historical moment where Luke O'Neill, the writer, did not, in fact, pee on the salmon dish of Bill Kristol, who he was serving in a Cambridge restaurant about a decade ago. We want to hear from you at 800-423-8255. That is 800-423-TALK. Phil from Newton, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have not read this article that you've been talking about, but I've listened to some of what the journalist has said, which repeats a very familiar trope, a very familiar lie, for example, about separating parents from their children and putting children in cages, which is kind of ridiculous. And by the way, the law that was passed that instigated this policy of separating children from parents was passed in the 90s. And it was implemented not only by subsequent presidents, not just so-called conservative presidents, but it was in full force during the Obama administration. I don't see the journalist having written or writing about peeing in an Obama supporter's
car. Phil, there is a lot of debate on the origins of this law and when it began. So I just want to table that there for a moment. Luke O'Neill, you say you wrote this with humor at first.
You were not
humorous at all about what you observed at the border under the watch of Kirstjen Nielsen. And I wonder, you've gotten some flack on that. I want to just play this from Fox News host Tucker Carlson, who on Fox News last week commented on this incident. He said it was amazing that the Boston Globe is still in operation. He also got your last name wrong the first time he said it. He also called you a nutcase for arguing the op-ed was tongue in cheek. So let's listen to what he had to say.
Think that'd fly if an op-ed columnist at Boston Globe suggested poisoning Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton? Yeah, probably not. Not so long ago, it would not have been acceptable for anyone to say that. In America, we express disagreement through voting and public debate, what we're doing right now. We don't attack people or suggest poisoning them or scream at them if they dare go outside. That is the politics of fear and hatred and eventually, maybe not even so eventually, violence.
So this is someone who said some pretty inflammatory things himself, Tucker Carlson. But what does all of this say about what culture wars are playing out right now on the political landscape?
Well, can I say something
Please.
Here? First of all, Tucker Carlson's a white nationalist. And second of all, I don't this is really hard for me to say this without swearing. I do not care about Obama or Hillary Clinton. Like conservatives always say that, like, well, Obama did him. And I'm like, okay, well, get him too. Like, is that supposed to be some sort of checkmate? Like, it's okay to tear families apart because a Democrat did it? I could not care less about Obama or anyone in his administration. If they were in power right now, I'd be saying the same thing.
I want to remind listeners that we are talking with Luke O'Neill and with John Carroll about a column that was in the Boston Globe last week and also pulled down because of how Luke O'Neill wrote the column, a reference to thinking about peeing in the dinner of someone he was serving, a political conservative named Bill Kristol, some will remember. This is about 10 years ago. It was connected to Secretary of Homeland Security Kirstjen Nielsen, the former secretary, that is, and her resignation from the Trump administration. John Carroll, this may be a repeat in a way and redundant, but we're talking about the placement of humor, which is how, in a way, or satire in journalism, in an opinion piece in the Globe. But we heard our listener in Newton say he thought there was no place for this. Where is the line drawn, again, in these legacy publications.
Well, humor is in the eye of the beholder very often.
Right,
so
right.
So that's one issue. The other issue is the parallel information universes that people are living in now. And the idea of sort of shared, mutually agreed upon facts is something that is vanishing quickly. So it makes it much harder to have any kind of reasonable public discourse. And this became tribal in 30 seconds. You know, basically, it was, you know, the ideology split that was erupted on Twitter was something where everybody dug in and were basically attacking each other, and there was no conversation. And one of the issues and one of the concerns of a lot of mainstream media organizations is how to have some kind of civil discourse. And you see a lot of people, a lot of organizations, including NPR, have eliminated comment sections because basically can't keep them civil. They can't keep them on topic either, which becomes an issue. And so what you have is all of this rolled up into one combustible incident that brings out sort of the extreme views of a lot of people, and people who want to have a civil conversation about it, it's much, much harder to do.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot in this story, Luke O'Neill. Maybe, you know, all of this brings up an incredible conversation that is one about where we are technologically, where journalism goes, and editorially. Let's get to some of those callers again, because there's some good insight here. Michael from Leominster, thanks for calling in to Radio Boston.
Hi, I'm a former newspaper reporter and editor, and I think this is really a failure of the Boston Globe to have stopped this piece before it was ever even published. So I'm reminded of 2009, Playboy ran an article about, I'm going to clean up the language, about having hate sex with conservative women, and they pulled it, and it really does seem like something that is beyond the pale and never should have gotten as far as going past the editor's desk.
John, what do you think about that? John Carroll, who has written for the Globe, who has been a media analyst for a long time.
I would say, yeah, just on a personal level, I was surprised that it made it in that form to the Globe website. And again, I know they're reaching out to a new audience, but it just seemed to me out of character with the Globe, and I knew that it was going to be something that was going to blow up in their faces pretty much as soon as I saw it.
Luke O'Neill, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah.
Please go ahead.
What are we even talking about here? We're I said, you know, I made like a crude joke about peeing in someone's dish or administration officials, you could very easily argue are committing massive human rights violations as we speak, and hoping to make them worse, you know, somehow. And the fact that anyone could spare any of their outrage for me saying pee pee poo poo in the newspaper is just blowing my mind. It's just really weird. It's just, I don't know what norms, people seem to think there's some norms left, but there are not. Donald Trump is president. No, there are no more norms.
And so you had the Boston Globe taking a notion that they would publish this, right? But it was about the language that was used, or about this vision that somebody, and namely, I imagine the publishers, the Henrys, said this is too, this is inappropriate. And it may have been about, we don't know if it was about the pee and the poo and whatever else, but or if it was about, you know, what they read into it. So you've opened up a good conversation, Luke O'Neill. Last words, we've got to wrap up. Anything? I mean, where this goes from here?
I think for John Henry, like all billionaires everywhere, is very uncomfortable by the idea of people taking any sort of action and having any sort of power. And, you know, maybe more than me saying pee, that made him uncomfortable.
Luke O'Neill, thank you so much for joining us by Skype today. Luke O'Neill is a writer, a journalist, and has contributed in the past to the Boston Globe. WCBUR senior news analyst John Carroll, it's really good to see you. It's been a long time. The man behind the blog, it's good to live in a two-daily town. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. We've probably all heard that old chestnut, Boston is the Athens of America, a hub of cultural influence, democratic values, and staid intellectualism. Yale historian Mark Peterson, who's here with us, takes that comparison even farther. He argues that Boston, over hundreds of years, starting in the mid-17th century, carved itself into what he calls a New England city-state empire. That's before it was fully absorbed into the new, then new, larger nation with the ratification of the Constitution. And he says that ratification was detrimental to Boston and to Massachusetts going into then the 18th and 19th centuries. So a bit of a history lesson at this moment. His book spans three centuries, which he acknowledges is an unusually deep time span for a book on one American city. But it is called The City-State of Boston, The Rise and Fall of an Atlantic Power. Mark Peterson, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
Boy, it's a heavy book, too. It's got a good paper stock. You know, it's a really big book, but we are going to take a sliver. A little background. You begin with the Puritans. You take us through the Civil War, and throughout, you refer to Boston as a city-state. What does that mean, exactly, in your definition of history?
Well, in effect, I'm describing the origins of Boston as something like the last Renaissance city-state, in that its founders imagined that they were doing something quite like what lay at the origins of a place like Venice, for instance. That is, part of their commitment, of course, was religious, and they looked to the Bible, to the apostles, and conceived that they were bringing apostolic Christianity to a new continent in much the way that, say, the Apostle Paul had done in the first century. And they even went so far as to make the Great Seal of the Massachusetts Bay Company be, in effect, a quotation from St. Paul in the dream that he has that a man from Macedon asks him to come over and bring Christianity there. And so the Great Seal of Massachusetts has the image of a Native American, an Indian, quoting Paul's dream, saying, come over and help us.
Mm-hmm. And we're not going to get to this today, but there's an issue with the symbol on the Massachusetts flag, which is also from the 17th century, questioning that symbol now in the 21st century.
Right.
Would you though paint a picture of Boston in the 1600s as an autonomous city-state where Native Americans are living, where the colonists show up? What's it look like?
Well, at the beginning, Boston, the founders of Boston are doing something that no other English colony had really managed up to that time. That is bringing really large numbers of colonists over, something like 20,000 in the first 10 years, and settling on a tract of territory that was granted in their charter that was quite small compared to the other colonial projects in early America. And so starting from Massachusetts Bay and planting themselves on the Shawmut Peninsula that becomes Boston, they begin essentially fanning out, finding farmland, finding places to settle. And so the first part of the book describes this process and how essentially Boston hives off not only Massachusetts but other new colonies like Connecticut and New Hampshire, and Maine becomes part of Massachusetts.
Are we calling it New England yet?
Yes, they are, but they were actually calling it New England before then. That is, the English crown, the early colonists, tended to call the whole region north of Virginia New England. And so what Boston is doing is essentially claiming a part of it and expanding that claim through the course of the 17th century.
And then what was happening in the other colonies at the time? Was it unparalleled at all?
Well, most of them were struggling quite badly. One of the things that makes Massachusetts succeed early on, that is, to a much greater degree, is that many of those 20,000 colonists were selling off their assets in England, their farms, their shops, etc., bringing their money with them and using it to invest in the colony. And so Massachusetts was much better supported than, say, Virginia was in its early days. And they turned that investment towards a very idealistic vision of the kind of colony they want. Mm-hmm. So that includes, famously, the Puritan churches that every town was required to produce, but also a very intensive form of self-government, of republican government, that also was quite antithetical to English tradition at the time.
And healthy in this area. I realize this is a story of colonists. This is not a mm-hmm. story about coming to this land where Native Americans were living in various tribes that we know of today and who are still here today. So we're not going to get too much into that. We do want to hear again about this sort of notion that Massachusetts and Boston in particular was above and beyond anything else going on and could have stayed that way had it not been for the Constitution. We're going to jump really fast ahead, a couple of centuries to the American Revolution of 1776. And before that time, we learned that, Boston has managed to defeat the crown. They overthrew the governor of the Dominion of New England. The city has persisted. Today you have the Freedom Trail, right, and Patriots Day, and all these things are marking what it managed to do as a city. And then the U.S. Constitution becomes ratified, and you say that you are unique in saying this as an historian, that it wasn't such a good thing for Boston, that maybe it took away what Boston could have been.
Well, yes, and let me make clear from the beginning that I don't mean that many of the things that are in the U.S. Constitution that, are revered today or that have been beneficial are things that Boston and Massachusetts were opposed to. The Bill of Rights, for instance, was in many ways the product of the efforts of Massachusetts in the ratification process. The Massachusetts Constitution had a Bill of Rights, and the lack of that in the original draft of the National Constitution is something that Massachusetts voters in their constitutional convention insisted ought to be in the Constitution. So I don't mean it in that sense. What I mean is that while it was officially a colony of Britain, Boston had created this city-state and had managed to remain or to retain a great deal of autonomy, of self-government under that. And its economy had linked it to other parts of the British Empire, most importantly to the economy of the West Indies, where huge numbers of enslaved people were being forced to produce sugar. And so that was economically viable for Massachusetts, but the advantage under the British Empire was the planters of the West Indies had no political control over or authority over Boston and Massachusetts. And what changed with the U.S. Constitution was that from that point forward, the United States or Massachusetts was voluntarily making itself part of a United States Congress where a slave-owning dominant majority would have direct power over Massachusetts.
Right, and that being Virginia,
Carolina, all of the southern slave-holding states whose power was augmented by the Three-Fifths Clause to be able to pass laws that in the very short run actually were quite detrimental to Boston and New England's interests.
So let's keep giving listeners a timeline. So we Massachusetts likes to remember that itself as the center of the abolition movement, but that was the 19th century. But before that, there was a slave trade, as you just described, and much of the region's economy depended on it. But let's dig into this idea that with the Constitution, Massachusetts ceded that control and power to the southern states, to those slaveholders. Could there have been another way? Rewrite history, right?
But there already was another way, mm-hmm. which we call the Articles of Confederation, right? Which was a pact among equal states. And that pact had, for instance, no taxing power over individuals. And it required supermajorities for the national government to take powerful action. And under that system, it would have been impossible for the national government to do things like embargo the entirety of the United States trade, which the Jefferson administration does in 1807, and which is horribly destructive to Massachusetts for 2 years, where the city cannot legally trade outside of Boston Harbor.
So, you write this book now. It may be just that you've been working on it for a decade or 5 years, or maybe your entire, 20 years. And you say much of this, much of the information you based your research on and your writing has been available in archives. You have pulled together a different narrative, not of what happened, but what could have been by looking at the strength of this city-state through these 3 centuries. What? Why now, if there is an answer to that? Why, besides that it took 20 years to write, why is it important to know this story?
Well, it's an excellent question. It isn't a counterfactual history. Everything in it that happened did happen, right? But one of the problems that I was trying to deal with all along is the way in which the modern history of the United States casts a shadow backwards over the colonial history. And so it tends to sort events from the past into favoring those that led obviously towards the United States and obscure those that don't move in that direction. And what I was trying to do was to highlight how contingent, how uncertain the evolution of the United States was, and actually focus on an alternative kind of polity, because actually for the past 20 years or so, I've been fairly convinced that the United States is in serious trouble, that its constitution is broken, that the role of the nation state internally and in the world is suffering from some serious problems. And so I thought it was a good idea to give a consideration anyway to the long history of a place that operated in different terms, that governed itself on a much more local basis.
Right. We won't have time today to talk about whether Philadelphia or New York City could have, you know, in its early days through those three centuries done anything. You're saying no. But I do want to ask you quickly, because we have about a minute, that, you know, you just mentioned this. What lessons can we learn from history as you look forward as an historian and a scholar at where we are today? What did the Bostonians back then give us? What might you tap into or spread the word on?
The first thing I would say is that when things needed changing, they changed them. When things were worth preserving, they preserved them, right? And so I do think that the United States is in a bind today, constitutionally and politically, and it's incumbent on us to figure out how to change them, not to mindlessly or blindly simply preserve the past.
Well, Mark Peterson, thank you for writing this. It is very readable, by the way. It's just large, like 800 pages plus index, right? It's a wonderful look back. It's complicated, too, and maybe controversial. Thank you for coming in. Mark Peterson is a professor of history at Yale University. The book is called The City-State of Boston, The Rise and Fall of an Atlantic Power, 1630 to 1865. Thanks again.
Many thanks.
Mark Peterson will be speaking tonight at the Massachusetts Historical Society. He'll be at the Harvard Coop April 25th. You can find out more from our website, radioboston.org. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, and Eve Zukoff. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Renee Marchaudon. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hati. I'm Jill Kaufman. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.